Hi, I'm Owen.
And I'm Chris.
And this is Dead Wargamer Society.
So, this week, we are going to be covering Mordheim, and we're really lucky to have an awesome guest on with us. We have Ash Barker from Guerrilla Minigames. He runs, and where you probably know him from, is he runs a very, very popular YouTube channel, which is Guerrilla Miniature Games. It covers so many things. I don't even think we could get into like a list of all the different games that are covered on here, but it is literally every mini game, not just supported ones, but dead ones, fan created ones. He goes into reviews of different products. He goes into painting. At points, he goes back into his like little treasure trove of history's greatest minis that somehow just all exist in his studio. Ash had worked over at Games Workshop from about 2001 to 2014. He was involved in releasing a miniature agnostic mech game called Gamma Wolves, and is also involved in Blaster Magazine, which is a kind of collaboration between a bunch of different great indie game developers. Owen also had some notes in here that were in French. I don't speak French, so Owen might need to cover that part.
It was a joke about Ash being from Ontario, so he probably speaks French. That's actually literally what it says.
Fair.
So, you heathen.
Welcome, Ash.
How you been, Ash?
I'm great. How are you guys?
Doing good, doing good. Thank you so much for swinging by.
Yeah, for sure. I think the only thing that I was interjecting during the intro when I was so fortuitously muted was... I do have one more game, a zombie apocalypse game with a couple of supplements for Osprey called Last Days of Zombie Apocalypse, which is a sort of like a warband skirmish survival game kind of time.
Correct me if I'm wrong, there's been a lot of supplemental stuff for Last Days in Blaster Magazine, is that right?
Yeah, the first two issues had some new fun like rules for changing it in time. So basically what I did was I started a couple different series of things in Blaster for Last Days. Like one of them was taking the zombie apocalypse movie to different eras, because it's a pretty famous trope of like, what happens if there were zombies in like World War II? What happens if there's zombies in, I don't know, like medieval times? So I did a first one, it was the Old West. So I could do Cowboys versus Zombies, and that was super fun. And the second one was kind of changing the bad guys, because one of the big request in Last Days was for more like mutant zombies. You know, like as time goes on, the zombies get like tougher and more mutated and stuff. Mm-hmm. And so I created rules for, you know, like spinning zombies and charging zombies and all kinds of other crazy types of zombies. But then by creating kind of like more advanced AI rules for the kind of environmental menace that is the monsters on the table that you're both kind of like fighting around, I was able to also add rules for different kinds of monsters. So I also did like an unshackled AI apocalypse where the game is totally reskinned and instead of zombies, it's kind of like that episode of Black Mirror or like the Terminator where like an AI's gotten unshackled and it's sending all its various like drones after you and stuff.
Nice.
And you try to survive against that. Yeah, just always playing the game. Like that's kind of the idea was I sort of intentionally left the core game like open so that you could do that. And like if you're our technology level, the bad guy doesn't matter. You still have the same sort of gear to try and survive it. You know what I mean? Like, yeah, whatever the bad guy is, you got the things you can find in your garage pretty much to try and stop them. And that's it.
Nice.
So we usually kick off most of these podcasts just talking about what we've been doing to hobby lately. So what have you been up to mini-wise?
Well, this week I have been working on my buddy Mike Hutchinson's new release from Osprey, which is A Billion Suns. And it's a 2 to X, like however many players. 2 to 12 players game of the best way to describe it for people who are familiar with video games, it's kind of like if EVE Online was a miniature game. So you play the CEO of like a 3,000 years in the future corporation, and you're trying to like dominate your opposition financially by completing different contracts out in like sort of human space, human controlled space. And this could be everything from like, you know, like a demolition contract, like destroy like aging sort of like installations, or you know, you're trying to like smuggle goods or rob somebody or whatever. And so you're spending your own like potential victory points, bringing in and requisitioning ships and independent contractors to go and like do all this work for you. And like you can get stuff by pirates and your opposing forces and stuff. And so it's a big space fleet game, but it's very like multiplayer friendly. And it uses kind of like a Malifaux style contract deck where you generate 3 random contracts at the beginning of every game. and all the players are trying to buy for those contracts. So there's this fun kind of elasticity in victory conditions where you're playing each other. Again, it's miniature agnostic, so like you can play whatever minis you want. If you got some old BFG minis or drop fleet minis or whatever kicking around, you're ready to rock and roll. You can start playing some Billion Suns. That's one of those $20 blue books from Osprey.
Nice.
Awesome. Mm-hmm. Chris, what have you been up to?
I've been polishing off the few models I have left for Eden, getting those painted, and kind of screwing around with color scheme ideas for when Warzone Eternal comes out. So I know it's a little bit far in advance, but I had some Hero Forge models kicking around that kind of fit the post-apocalyptic kind of Asian-inspired theme. So I'm playing around with color shifts and seeing how, if that's actually going to work for me.
Cool.
What about you, Owen?
I've been on a big battle tick kick lately, so just loving having an airbrush and oil washes, and everything's painting up quick. I got my House Liao stuff ready to be terrible and spread some fuckery. So yeah, really looking forward to playing some Alpha Strike on the other side of the pandemic.
Yeah, I've painted a shameful amount of battle tech since like November. It's crazy how I've painted 3 battle tech armies since November. Painting up 6 mil stuff is so satisfying because like it's so quick.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, those Catalyst Game Lab bottles, too, are awesome. Like, I've really been impressed by their plastic.
Yeah, they're dynamite. Absolutely. Yeah. I've been trying to get my hands on the previous iteration plastic just so that I have them, like, to compare them to. Like, kind of skinny looking Atlas and all that stuff that was in the previous starter set. But I've been having too much luck trying to get my hands on it. I gotta deep dive into the great miniature symmetry to try and come up with that starter set.
Yeah, no, that stuff has been really awesome. I think both Owen and I can blame Bobby, because Bobby actually came on for our Battletech episode.
Did he?
Yeah, and shortly after that, Bobby is doing Bobby stuff. Yeah, so he got really into Battletech, I think, because of the Harebrained Schemes video game. And then we did the episode on it, and I think afterwards both Owen and I were like, oh man, we have some Battletech stuff, we should probably paint that, play some games. And yeah, we both painted up a absurd, like, it's so easy, like you said, you know, like you paint up like a couple models, and they paint up so fast, and mm-hmm. it you just don't need that many, but you, because they're so cheap now, and they paint so fast, you just get way more than you actually need.
Yeah, and Wave 2's coming soon, too, actually, from Kickstarter, so there's going to be more stuff coming up pretty soon, which I'm pretty pumped for.
Right.
Some of the bigger stuff's in that, too, like the King Crab and the Kodiak and, like, all these, like, huge, like, 100-ton mechs will be coming in that, awesome. Too. It's awesome. And I slept on Battletech for 30 years, so, like, it's fun to dive into something that's got, like, that rich of a history, like, later on in life, because you just have this, like, endless supply of, like, shit to flip through on your phone when you're going to bed. You know what I mean? You're like, oh, just go to Camo Specs again and go reload some random mercenary company. Cool.
and they have their own library of books too, which is bananas. Like the same thing, you know, you look into it, it's like, man, like, you know, I played some Mech Warrior, but I did not know it like existed on this level.
I'm taking a great joy too in the amount of like gatekeeping of me not knowing shit, where people are like, you don't deserve to talk about Battletech, man. You don't know. I live the Battletech. Like, I'm making Battletech videos that have like, I don't know, 10,000 views or something. People like lose their minds. Like,
listen to this guy. It hurts me to hear him talk about this. He don't know shit about Battletech.
And I'm just like, cool. I like robots. Maybe this robot should go. Like, we didn't even know there was like timelines in the beginning, so we were just taking like, well, this mech's wicked. I'll do this. And they were like completely like a different like eras. Like one was like a lost tech mech, and it's just like totally illegal army lists, and everybody's watching and going, Battletech looks so cool. But like, there's like a 5% of people watching this pulling their hair out,
spit taking the whole thing. It was great.
You're having fun the wrong way. Stop.
That's right. Exactly. Yeah. Man,
you have failed. You failed as a man.
I haven't encountered the Battletech hipsters yet, but I'll have to keep an eye out for it.
They're there, buddy. They're there. Did you wait? It's great. It's glorious. I never get sick of like making people angry by not knowing as much as they do. That's my lot in life. I'm just being like, I'm gonna have fun with this. I like robots. And I was like, you don't love robots like I love robots.
Well, I mean, getting into something that you most likely know more than both Owen and myself about, we are here to talk about Mordheim today, which I'll let Owen kind of kick off with his fancy wiki-style description.
So, Mordheim, classic tabletop skirmish-scale campaign game set in the Warhammer Fantasy universe, released by Games Workshop in the year of the Lord, 1999, designed by Alessio Cavatori, Tomas Pinin, butchering his name, I'm sure.
Thomas Piernan. It's just pronounced Thomas.
Well, there you go.
Thomas Pierre.
Ah, fancy.
Already knowing more than you.
No, it's the spell words.
Just European, just European names. You're good.
The game originally came out in 1999 as a box set, but it got a lot of additional rules from the usual sources of Games Workshop extra rules. So things like White Dwarf. They also had some rules in the Fnatic supplement, something called Town Crier. So lots of rules out there. I think the last release that was official from Games Workshop was the 2007 Nemesis Crown campaign. Game uses D6s, 28mm heroic scale miniatures like most of the other Games Workshop games, and takes somewhere between 12 and 20, but usually closer to 15 to 20 models to play with. So, Ash, for someone that's never heard of Mordheim, do you want to give like a quick background on what the game's about?
Sure. So Mordheim, there's a few other bits and pieces in the history of Mordheim that's kind of worth mentioning. It came out during a really interesting period in the GW design studio where they got a lot of license to kind of experiment. And what's interesting about that is this is the era in the mid to late 90s where White Dwarf, you could just get shit for free. You might pick up your issue of White Dwarf and have like a whole new game just like floating in it. And that was that's something that's talked about a lot nowadays. It's like White Dwarf's never been as good as it was in the 90s and stuff like that, because you'd see people kind of like the game design studio put stuff out to just kind of gauge interest. And White Dwarf and actually Battlefleet Gothic as well were actually free games in Mordheim and Battlefleet Gothic as well were free games in White Dwarf before they were published.
Oh, wow.
as separate box games. And so the interesting thing about Mordheim is it was this, well, we want to make a fantasy game to sell more fantasy stuff that doesn't scare away people, because Necromunda is doing really well and people really seem to like this idea of playing like smaller games, and so let's do something and let's like spitball and kind of brainstorm a game. And then on top of that you have this fabulous cultural insanity happening in the late 90s with the approaching millennium. There's a really good tricky album called Pre-Millennium Tension that kind of talks about all that. But the whole like thrust of Mordheim was, even in the game, what if something insanely apocalyptic did happen in 1999? And it's actually set in almost like the Horus Heresy era of the Warhammer world. So it's during the time of like multiple emperors and pre-Magnus the Pious, Great War Against Chaos is happening. And you've got this like weird empire that's very divided, where there's multiple electric counts being the emperor. And in the midst of all this like debauchery, you've got the Church of Sigmar being all crazy. They're very draconian. They've sent out their Templars to like fight against chaos. And then in the year 1999, this giant comet descends from the skies, totally obliterates one of the cities called Mordheim. And so that box game was sort of the first, it spawned like a whole genre of fantasy style games where you're in like a post-apocalyptic fantasy setting, like a destroyed city. It's all haunted by demons and ghosts and the undead or whatever. And the MacGuffin is that the comet breaks apart into these incredibly valuable chunks called Warpstone, and that's what you're all there on the hunt for. So there's a big gold rush, everybody descends on Mordheim, and that sets the scene for, you know, having every fantasy race eventually represented basically in this like one boxed game. And the game itself was a really good value. You got, I think, 12 or 16, because I think the box came with 16 actually, militia, Citadel Warhammer militia. Mm-hmm. And they were a wonderful fantasy sprue that allow you to make almost any kind of like kind of generic fantasy fighter. And you can have guys with axes, you can have guys with double-handed weapons, crossbows, bows. It was a really cool mix and match modular fantasy kit to kind of just make your own little D&D characters. And then it came with multi-part Skaven Nightrunners that could also be equipped with like a ton of just like weird cool weapons too, like flails and fighting claws and throwing stars and throwing daggers and stuff. And for the time, the kits were actually really technologically advanced. So for me in the late 90s, the 90s were kind of, I don't say plagued, but famous for Games Workshop and Citadel producing these kind of like push-fit, monopose plastics. But, I mean, they're functional. We call them unit fillers. You know, like your front rank would be the metal guys because they were expensive, and the back rank would be these like plastic beastmen or plastic cast warriors, whatever, to fill out your unit, because it was like $6 for six cast warriors or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But these plastics were really nice. They had good proportions. Their hands weren't as, you know, the Skaven maybe a little bit, their hands were, you know, as big as their heads or whatever, but They were nicely detailed. They had lots of mix and match swapping parts. And you got lots of them in the box. I think you got 12 and 12, actually. I think you got 12 like Empire Mercenaries, and you got 12 Skaven. And then you got some really nice cardstock terrain, all illustrated by the current, at the time, Warhammer Design Studio. So you had some really famous artists in there. Of course, John Blanche with the art design, which also had Alex Boyd, one of my favorite 90s to early 2000s Citadel artists, illustrating a lot of it. And he is the guy who did most of the when second edition turned into third edition 40K and fourth edition 40K. He was the guy that grimdarked 40K. And doesn't get a lot of credit very often, but he's the guy who took that 90s style where there's like 17 different artists in every 40K book and nailed it down this one grim black and white like art style. He did a lot of cutting his teeth in Mordheim as well. I did some really incredible art for that in the 6th edition fantasy book. And that was basically for that year, it was fully supported with a range of plastic and metal miniatures. You had a faction box for all the supported factions on the rulebook, which is the Undeads. You had metal character and hero models for all of the mercenary companies. So initially it was Middenheimers, Marienburgers, and Reichlanders. And then you had the Skaven sort of like accessories as well to like augment those plastics. You had a Warlock, Assassin Adept, and some Gutter Runners, which are Night Runners, which were the baby guys. And two Black Skaven, who were the sort of like mid-level heroes. And then a gorgeous set of Sisters of Sigmar, who were the only good guys basically left in the city. And who are actually from the city. They live in their convent that was like the one building that survived the coming of the comet. You had the Undead, which was actually just a couple character models and then a mix of the plastics. They came with a selection of the current then zombie miniatures from Warhammer, which I think are actually still in production to this day, but the zombies are getting really old. They're like 20, 22 years old. And who else? The Possessed, the Cult of the Possessed, which had some interesting miniatures and a really nice Witch Hunter warband. Of which some of the, I think, nicest models in Mordheim came out, and those were mostly primarily in metal. You had a full cast of characters, too, some Dramatis Personae, so you had all the mercenary models, like the Halfling Cook, the Ogre, the Pit Fighter, there was the Dwarf Troll Slayer from Mordheim, was really nice, and the Elf Ranger, and then you had these, like, character models, who are these, like, big-name dudes, like Johan the Knife, you had Ender the Sword of Twilight, whoever you ever showed up would just kill everyone in both warbands, because he was just impossible to stop. You had what was his name? Is it Vesket? I know there's the one, the like half robot assassin, and a couple of other guys. Yeah, he was the one who had the fight claws, the pistols built into them, so he had like the shooty hands. He had warlock pistols built into his fighting claws, and then Nicodemus, who they had to write a story about because they sculpted him too big. They sculpted this enormous miniature of a fighting fantasy character named Nicodemus, who lived under the bridge in Port Blacksand, and then had to basically explain why he was like head and shoulders taller than all the other human models. It's like, dog, he had a rock that makes him big. And I was like, and it's the funny thing, it was a total accident. They just sculpted him on a scale and then put him next to like a human miniature. I'm like, he's a lot bigger than these miniatures. He's like an old man. And they're like, aw, just write the story. It's like, Nicodemus ate magic rocks and the beans made a pig. It's like one of those like Design Studio stories where it's like, what? But yeah, that's what happened. Anyway, and that's it in a nutshell. It ran until Fanatic Magazine, issue 10, and Empire in Flames, which is actually the last official supplement for it. It had its own magazine for a while called Town Crier that was also collected in the Best of Town Crier. And a bunch of expansion warbands and stuff came out as well. So you had additional things like there was a whole separate campaign system with Lustria, Cities of Gold, and that gave you things like Dark Elves and the Shadow Warriors and stuff, the Norse, and various other like different like Lizard Infections and stuff. And eventually it kind of just roped in every fantasy race. And it was a much beloved game, but of course it suffered from all the same problems that Necromunda suffered from, where you didn't have to buy that much stuff. And so kind of once you had everything, unless they dedicated like studio resources, which at the time, that's a big resource to dedicate to kind of a minor game. It kind of had a set one like shelf limit where you just couldn't keep that much product in stores, and two, kind of an inbuilt sort of like purchasing cap where people kind of bought everything and then they were like, well, I have all more of that stuff. Now what am I going to do? And the idea was to get into fantasy, but fantasy was such a different animal that it didn't necessarily attract like the Mordheim hobbyist.
So for someone that's never heard of Mordheim, but maybe plays current GW games, how would you compare and contrast this with something like Warcry?
I mean, like from a physical point of view, I'd say Warcry is really similar. And Warcry has like obviously a lot of the DNA of Mordheim in it. It's set in the Eight Points, which is like a city again in the middle of the Mortal Realms that's very much like the kind of same thing of as Mordheim. It was destroyed during the Great War Against Chaos. Anybody could be there because it's actually the doorway city that's in between all the other realms. And I guess the idea being that they didn't add like all the factions and try to make it a gateway game.
Yeah, I mean, it's basically the same thing. I think the difference is
you can't bottle premillennial year 2000 tension the way they did in Mordheim, right? So, like, no one today is going to appreciate, I think, a game like Warcry the way we appreciated Mordheim, because you're not living in a society currently obsessed with the end of the world and the Mayan calendar running out. So I would say they're basically the same thing, but you can release the exact same thing in different times and not get the same result because the audience is different. And that's, I think, the biggest difference between Mordheim and Warcry. Obviously, there's tons of mechanical differences, and close to the same engine. Like, but just throwing out the rules, because rules don't make a game, right? You only spend 80% of your time building and collecting toy soldiers and thinking about games, not just mechanically, like, operating the rules. They strive for the same kind of thing. And I think that the audiences are just in incredibly different places.
Yeah, I feel like the other really just big difference between the two of them is, I mean, obviously, prior to getting into the rules overview and whatever, between, like, Warcry and Mordheim is that Warcry, you can definitely have one-off games, and it's totally fine, and it works with the system. Mordheim was just always designed as, like, that campaign game. Like, I don't know if I'd really just want to play, a one-off game of time with someone else.
Yeah, people, though, I mean, that was the thing. Like, people played, like, more tournaments. Like, I literally remember people trying to, like, turn it into, like, a tournament. And the game just instantly broke. You know what I mean? Because there's just there's some army lists that are just better. Like, if you play Skaven, like, 80% of the time, if you just spam the table with, like, shooting and, you know, basic guys with, like, two swords, you'll just beat up everybody you play against. And that's not design flaw in the game, right? Because the game's not intended to be played that way. The game's intended to be played by folks who like building these unique story-driven characters that look cool and have equipment just because the model looks really nice. And, you know, that's what the guy who built it likes. Not anything to do with, you know, well, if everyone has two swords, technically they're the best. So have two swords, then you have two parries. So everyone has two swords. Your wizard has two swords. My wizard has two swords. Everyone has two swords. Did you buy armor? I don't buy armor because armor's too expensive. I got two swords. I'm like, okay, good job, buddy. I spent a lot of time in gaming stores, and I can just hear people talking that way. Sorry, I'm sorry not to. That's setting anybody off and triggering them. But there's a guy in every gaming store that talks like that. There's two swords. That's too real. I know.
I mean, like, I feel like that's fine. You know, whoever you piss off, they mainly send the hate mail to Owen.
That's fair. They've already been trying to burn my house down. I got cameras. Fine. I got insurance. Two swords coming for me. Stop it.
Moving along to rules, you know, because again, this is like, you know, for a lot of people, this might be their first introduction to Mordheim. You know, the game's a D6 game. Almost all roles in it are D6 based. You know, combat resolution.
D6 or
injuries.
D6, yeah.
D6 and D6. It's what was around in the 90s. You know, we didn't have this fancy stuff.
It was also what's available. There was a big design imperative actually at Workshop to make sure that you always played most Workshop games with stuff you could find in Monopoly box, right? You didn't want to have too much weird stuff because it was like a form of gatekeeping. So they second edition 40K, I think, was the last edition of any Warhammer game that had D&D dice.
Yep.
Right. So you still had D&D dice, not because it was your armor penetration actually used like D&D dice all the time. So it was like D8 plus D20 plus D6 plus D. It's like, what is happening? Why is there D&D algebra in my miniature game? I don't understand anything.
So essentially, in the game, your wand revolves around two kinds of figures. You have heroes and henchmen. Heroes have access to kind of an upgrade system and also a more elaborate injury chart. Henchmen, you know, their skill upgrades and injuries are a little bit more basic. There's tons of customization for your warband. Even just within one faction, two warbands can look just completely different. You have so many different war gear options, you know, including weapons, armor, shields, fancy little like magic trinkets and stuff like that. I believe one of the most popular is being the Lucky Rabbit's Foot.
Like a charm.
So there's just tons of stuff. And the more games you play, the more your warband ends up getting customized as you go through a campaign, whether it's good things like finding a bunch of super rare treasure or it's bad things like your model getting poked in the eye or having some other horrible, horrible injury.
A lot of amputation.
Yes.
Yeah. I'm trying to think. There were a couple of good injuries. Like, if you rolled super duper awesome, you could get like terrible scars, which would lead to terrifying your opponent, which is fantastic.
It's actually even more useful for not being subject to fear yourself. So it was good that you caused fear, but it was even better that the entire, like, if you got a guy, like let's say you're like Skaven, whose leadership, like, 5, got to cause fear, that was amazing, because it didn't mean he didn't instantly soil himself when he fought an undead warband and everything, and it causes fear. And you're like, oh, I guess I just can't charge anymore, because I just sit here wetting myself the entire game.
Essentially, the way the game was designed was that you have a few different people involved in a campaign. Two players, usually two players, sometimes occasionally 4, 5, 6, play in an event, which was your one-off game, your on-the-table game. And then the post-game was where you earn gold and XP, you roll injuries, and then you spend down all that stuff. In my experience with Mordheim, the post-game... the off-tabletop time usually took equal to, if not more time, than the actual time you spent on the table.
And you could also absolutely win the game and lose the post-game.
Yep.
Oh, yeah.
Like, that was a big part of Morgan. It's like, oh, well, I beat my opponent, and they bottled right away, except he got 85 times as much gold as I did, and nobody died.
You know, yeah, exactly. You roll well on those injury charts, you walk away with nothing bad happening. Meanwhile, the other, you know, you just played a game, you don't roll great on anything. You didn't grab enough of the objectives or what have you, so you walk away with pretty much nothing. Overall, the game was definitely designed to be a campaign. Like we kind of talked about before, it was not like a one-off thing. It's definitely not set up to be like a tournament system of, let's roll in 16 players and... While there's some basic balance, the balance is really based around the campaign. Like, some armies start a little bit weaker and they struggle a little bit in the early campaign, but by the time, you know, you get your super strong models at the end, it's, you just feel invincible.
It was inherently balanced too, that the bigger your warband got, the less gold you'd earned. That's a really clever mechanic, mm-hmm. actually, that Thomas put into it, where as your warband got bigger, the amount that you had to upkeep them became exponentially higher. And so you didn't have to worry so much about warbands getting totally out of control, because they would slowly start to eat themselves to death, right? They had more and more, basically, that they had to spend money on.
And between that and, I believe it was called, like, the underdog system, where essentially if you got beat down severely, and a lot of your experience was way lower than the opponent, a much higher rate of experience gained for that game, which was... a nifty mechanic.
Yeah, I think it was I preferred this mechanic to, like, say, the Blood Bowl or the Necromunda catch-up mechanic. I thought it was an elegant way to handle it.
Necromunda had the same, it was called a Giant Killer bonus in the first edition of Necromunda. It's definitely changed in the new edition. It's not quite the same as it was, but it's a similar mechanic. The idea being that if you showed up to the table for the first time, you didn't want to instantly be outclassed by someone who's been playing for like 6 weeks. Because there's always that, like, drop in, drop out in any campaign. And you need to have, it doesn't even need to be like perfect, but you need to have something acknowledging that sucks for one of the two players. So even if they don't get a ton of stuff out of the Giant Killer mechanic or the big, like, extra gang raiding mechanic, at least the game is saying, yeah, we know, he's better than you. That sucks. You got pantsed. But, you know, Jimmy learned how to shoot his bow a little bit better. And that makes your day not so bad.
Yeah, so Ash, what do you think are some reasons that someone would really like Mordheim or want to get into Mordheim?
Well, I mean, I think that the big thing with Mordheim is... it's almost more of an artistic movement than it is a game at this point. Mm-hmm. You can take those early 2000s Blanchitsu articles in White Dwarf, and that almost traces back to the beginning, where this fascination with that style of game, I think, currently on the internet originates from. Because it's not... I think of Mordheim and some of its successors, like the whole, like, the hashtag 28 movements. Right, yep. You've got guys doing like really artsy miniatures for 40K, for fantasy, for Age of Sigmar, for like, you know, old style games or old hammer, whatever. That's the like the mid 90s equivalent of like dudes with record bags talking about the band that you might like, but it's okay because you've probably never heard of them. You know, like it's I don't want to say that it's hipster Warhammer, but it's a little bit hipster Warhammer because it's looked at really fondly. You know what I mean? Like the way that like the Yardbirds and Lou Reed is looked at by record fans. Like it's not just the game itself, the mechanics or like the rules and stuff like that, which remain very functional, but they're basically just Warhammer. Like, they're basically just like the Warhammer stat line and hitting and winning. They don't do anything new outside of like 5th and 6th edition Warhammer. It's the fact that you've got this incredibly rich, dripping, artistic setting with a really compelling story and really unique characters. And the art design is really cool. And the stuff you find is really cool because it's not just stuff that makes you better. It's stuff that like fits the story and the narrative and stuff. That, to me, is the reason why people get into Mordheim today. Is you're looking backwards to try and find a feeling, basically, in miniature wargaming that isn't necessarily here anymore. Because you're not encouraged to, like, make your own miniatures the way you used to be. You're not really encouraged to, like, convert stuff or tell a story in your games. Like, if you were just to go online and talk to 80% of wargamers, the point of playing a wargame is to beat up your opponent in the most efficient way possible. And that's not what Mordheim is about. Mordheim is about collecting a really, you know, fun, interesting, small cast of characters and send them on these like compelling narrative adventures that aren't necessarily fair or balanced. Like, there's no like, life's not fair. Sometimes one warband just gets fucked. And that's just how it is. Like, sorry. Too bad. Go home and hope you have enough experience that Billy can fire his bow better. And if you can, then yay. And get two swords, because two swords are the best. Like, that's it. But if you're into it because you love like just because art style, and you love like a really wacky, fun sort of like narrative in your games, then Mordheim is probably for you. It's probably the game you've been looking for, or at least it has the feeling you might be looking for in an old style Warhammer game.
Yeah, I think nostalgia, both for the setting and for that feeling. And want to convert models are probably the big reasons I imagine anyone would want to grab Mordheim.
Them matter. Like, your models matter. They don't just die instantly. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, they stay around for a while. They don't just, like, evaporate to, like, a huge bucket full of dice. Like, when one die gets rolled and life and death can hang, like, a single die roll, it's just compelling. Like, it's compelling gaming.
Yeah, I think being able to convert, you know, a dozen really awesome models from the awesome Games Workshop plastic kits and not just have them be in a block of 50 of the same thing and then you go paint 80 other dudes to go, like, you can play Warhammer Fantasy without buying, you know, $1,000 worth of Warhammer Fantasy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and I mean, I think almost like it too, with the storytelling is a really big thing. It's, I think, you know, with Mordheim, it kind of crosses between almost like a role-playing game and a war game. Like, you, in all the record sheets, there's spots you name all your characters, like, which was a really unique concept, you know, because this was before skirmish games like, you know, Malifaux, where every character, you know, a lot of the characters are named characters, you know. This was, yeah, you know, even this lowly Skaven gutter runner, like, what's his name, what's his story? Which is a pretty neat thing.
Mm-hmm, definitely. It's the two games, one after the other, matter, and something happens in between. They don't just get put back in the box.
So, Owen, what are some reasons that you think might not be for people?
So let's just take the obvious one, the inverse of what Ash said. If you really want a competitively balanced game, if you want, you know, show up, bloody somebody's nose, and then, you know, get the trophy at the end of the day, you know, grab two swords and you're going to do it because not the most balanced game. It's not designed to be, but if that's what you're looking for, it's probably not going to make you love the game. There's a lot of RNG too. So even if you do everything right, it's hard to get the best stuff because a lot of those are on D66 tables.
Yep.
The only other thing I would say, if you're looking to pick this up and like play on your kitchen tabletop, just be ready to have a lot of terrain. The game, I think, works the best when there's a good amount of terrain. Thematically, it's supposed to be in a ruined city. So if you're looking to start quick, just be ready to also make, you know, more terrain than you might use in a Warhammer Fantasy game or in a Warcry game.
All right. So moving along. Ash, do you have any favorite Mordheim memories?
One of my Mordheim memories is usually all the terrible things that happen to me. I never remember the good stuff. The good stuff happens so rarely in Mordheim, but the bad things. I remember I had a young blood. So one of the things in Mordheim, for people who are listening, is you only actually have five guys ever usually that can do anything. If you get really lucky and one of your like plebes gets promoted to be a hero, you might get six, but some warbands never get that far. There's certain warbands who are notoriously low hero-wise, and the big problem with that is only the heroes can go do stuff. Only the heroes get to go exploring. Only the heroes can find you weird stone later on. Everybody else just goes and, like, sleeps in their hammock and eats, like, rats, basically, after the game. game's over. So if you lose your heroes during the course of a game, it could be a big deal. And I had one campaign where I had this young blood who's a human mercenary, like basic, like kid who hangs around the heroes. He counts the heroes, so he can go do hero stuff like book exploring. And there's one of the results you can find when you finish a game, which is you find a well. And there's a well down there, and the warband leader looks at the well, he looks at the young blood, he looks at the well, he looks at the one, he goes, and he kicks him in. And sometimes the young blood comes back with a piece of weird stone. Most of the time, though, he basically drowns. He hasn't missed the next game. I had a young blood spend 7 consecutive games at the bottom of a well. I kept rolling well. I kept kicking him back in there. My warband leader was just like, you don't come back until you find something. He's like, no, get out of here. And it was like the ring. Like, he just kept, like, crawling back at me. Like, I hate you so much, old man. I hate you so much. He's like, you don't even get clothes. You go back to that well. I stripped all his gear off. I took a sword. I took a bow. I took out a knife. I was like, I don't care. You make wood stone. If you don't come back with wood stone, I'm not coming back at all. And I kept throwing him down there. It was great. Yeah, 7 second games. I kept rolling well. I kept just throwing. I'm a terrible person, and it pleased me that.
I mean, I thought there'd be like a cool end to the story. It's like, oh yeah, and then he found like this. It's like, nope.
Timmy just spent all of the rest of his life bottom of a well. And like, I'm not saying that I renamed my warband leader Buffalo Bill, but I didn't not rename him Buffalo Bill.
And some say that it puts, is still down
it puts the weird stone on its skin, or as it goes back in the well again.
Chris, you want to go?
Yeah, mine's a little bit longer. So I actually missed the initial kind of Mordheim gaming thing. I was a little bit younger and didn't actually have a gaming group, so like I knew it existed. I was super excited by it, but I didn't have anyone to play with. So my first Mordheim campaign, I wasn't in until I was 30, like long past when the game was actually supported. And I had a, you know, pretty hardcore GW gaming group who every year would run a Mordheim campaign. And I was like, all right, I'll give it a shot. But I want to try to just, if I'm going to go all in on converting and stuff, I'm going to make something just weird that's a lot of fun to convert. So ended up trying to make a more human lizardman army, essentially looking kind of like the lizardmen from like Skyrim. So I was using Chaos Warrior bodies for my Saurus with the Saurus heads and some Saurus weapons. For the Skinks, I was using like Wood Elf Ranger bodies. I was super excited about it, but I was going in, I'm like, this looks really cool, but I don't really know like how well they're gonna play. Like, you know, they don't have good range options to start with. The Saurus are so slow, like you can't close with your opponent. Like there's so many like logistical problems with it early game. But then the person who was running the campaign decided to run it as a map-based campaign where certain of like the I forget what kind of scenario they're called, but normally they're like a one-off in most campaigns. Like you can do it once and they're designed to be played once and then never played again. And he basically tied it into certain areas on this map. You have this mission that can be replayed as long as someone challenges that your control of that area. So with my Lizardmen, I got the Ancient Library where at the end of the mission, you collect these tomes and you can open up these tomes with any henchman and they learn magic skills. So by the third round of this 16 round campaign, I had all of my henchmen, all of my like skink hunters, they were all magic users who had access to the Silver Arrows spell, which was possibly the most broken thing that I've ever heard of happening in Mordheim. Basically, because the Silver Arrows generated, I believe it was D6 arrows plus 2 every time you shot, ignored long range, ignored cover, and it was usually balanced out by the fact that most human magicians were like BS skip 2. As the game progressed, my skinks were up at like BS4, BS5. So I could basically drop anything in the game from range before it even closed. And yeah, it was an absurd campaign. The end game basically had three players teaming up just to murder me. And that was fantastic. And I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Oh, Lordy. Cool. I totally different best memories. I loved converting for the game. I came to it late too. At that point, it was kind of hard to track down the old metal Mordheim boxes that were the official releases. And most of my friends were just converting stuff from the plastics. So I converted a full Call to the Possessed list and loved every second of it. So it was just a pleasure to put together. Yeah, the game's fun. You know, I had a good time with my friends. It wasn't anything that, you know, totally blew my socks off. But, you know, I definitely had a good time playing it and glad I went through the process. Having said all that, we're getting a little bit over an hour now for time, so we should probably wrap things up. Before we do, we always ask our guests three questions. So, Ash, what's your favorite Dead War game?
Dead War game? I don't know. Dead or Dead to Me?
Dead, we're usually discussing games that are not currently supported. So, games that don't have an official, like...
There's so many.
Yeah.
I have more Dead War Games miniatures probably than Live War Game miniatures at this point in my life. If I was to, I mean, it depends on what I'm in the mood for though. Like if I'm in the mood, so I'm gonna say favorite Dead War Game that's like Mordheim, because Mordheim will never die. People are still playing Mordheim today. All the rules are free online. But game I can't get a game of right now that I wish I could. That's kind of like Mordheim. I really miss Confrontation. I loved Confrontation. It's one of my all-time favorite gaming experiences. Mostly, not, again, because necessarily the game was amazing, but I very fondly remember the time in my life in which I played a lot of Confrontation. Like, I was in my, like, early 20s and didn't have a lot of responsibility. I could stay up until 3 o'clock in the morning, you know, fucking about and playing a miniature game with my buddies. And it was one of those, again, you had this, like, bespoke crew of, like, really nice individual miniatures. We built a beautiful little, like, 12-inch by 24-inch table that we'd, you know, it would basically live at different people's houses. It would travel around, and we'd watch movies on that fancy new digital DVD and, like, or the Blu-rays, the brand-new Blu-rays. And like, you know, just play these, like, really fun games of like, a sort of small-scale skirmish fantasy game. So I'd say probably Confrontation.
Do you prefer C3 or C3.5?
3.5, just because it cleared up all the magic. I really wanted there to be like a proper magic phase in it, and the problem with 3 is that like you're basically playing with all the little rule books out of the packets, and like they weren't super well translated, and yeah. Anyway, three point five is the best that it got. Three is still a great game, but like fixing magic and making it like actually useful it made the game great.
Right on. Are there any Dead War games you wish people knew more about?
I mean, not really, because I think the problem with knowing too much about Dead War games is that you stop appreciating things for what they are. Right. Like, okay. I think the best example of that is, you know, the kind of loaded question. I got a ton of heat and also a ton of like, yeah, you go, boy, when I reviewed Warcry. And it wasn't and I wasn't really sure how I felt about it in the beginning because it wasn't what I was expecting. I was expecting Mordheim. You know what I mean? And and when I didn't get Mordheim, and also when I read like the boilerplate for it and it talked about being able to do things that really sounded like Mordheim. But then it wasn't really Mordheim, and I was like, is this? I feel like this game got like rewritten halfway through and isn't maybe what they thought they were making initially. I feel like if I just not had any expectations going in, because don't get me wrong, I love Warcry. Like I've played the hell out of Warcry. I love playing Warcry Catacombs. It's a fantastic like pick up and play game. I'm at a time in my life where I don't want to spend a ton of time playing miniature games. And even getting ready to play miniature games. So like having like a fast play campaign skirmish game is a ton of fun. It's a very mechanically clean system. Like, it's a great game. But I feel like my expectations kind of ruined my initial, like open the box giddy joy because I've played too many old games. You know what I mean? And I compare everything to something I played before. And that can get to the point where it's not healthy anymore.
Absolutely. Yeah, I was very skeptical of Warcry when I first heard about it, and it was actually last weekend when I first played it, and I loved it. It was not what I was expecting, but what you know, it is what it is, and I really enjoy that thing.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that is a problem of being a member of the Dead War Gamer Society, is that it's very easy to become jaded. You know what I mean? It's very easy to become Two Swords guy. Don't be Two Swords guy. just because shit was good back in the day doesn't mean shit's like gotta always be the way it was back in the day. So I say take all that stuff with a grain of salt, and every game should be kind of like judged on its own merits, and give every game a chance, because it's not like something that you like back in time doesn't make it bad.
Amen to that.
I am really, really tempted to put like Twins behind the DWS logo. I think that's the way to go moving forward.
Oh, Lordy. Is there anyone you want to give a shout out to?
Right now, shout out my boy Bobby Limoji. I hope he's doing good. It's cool to hear his name. I haven't chatted with him in a while. I'm stoked he's playing some Battletech. Shout out to, you mentioned Brian CP Steele, who's working on new Mutant Chronicles. That's cool as hell. I hope he's doing okay. And everybody else that I just haven't seen, like you guys, man. You two, I haven't seen you guys since the last Adepticon. That's been too long. It's been 2 years now. We're two Adepticons like late. I think I saw you last actually at Kumani Expo. We played some Underworlds, didn't we? At Adepticon 2019.
Yeah, I saw you at the last Adepticon. I actually think we played Underworlds Adepticon 2018.
That's true. I think you're right.
And
yeah, I think
I did see you. I did see you 2019, but I think we played some Underworlds 2018.
That's right. Yeah. It's all a blur now. It's all a shocking blur.
Yeah, all in the before four times.
Before the booty booms.
But I mean, as far as Ash's projects go, to check, you know, take a look into, definitely check out Guerrilla Mini Gaming, or GMG. They are,
it's just awesome, easier to say GMG. Channel. It's less, yeah, less emotional. just for now, just be like, just go check out GMG. It's way easier. Rolls off the tongue.
But yeah, check it out. They're definitely, I think, when it comes down to wargaming channels to watch on YouTube, they're definitely some of the most entertaining. Ash is generally a very, excitable guy in the videos, which is a lot of fun to watch. It's not dry.
I think you said that to me when we first actually met. You're like, you're just like you are in the videos in real life. It's like, yeah. And then you gave me this look like, it's going to be exhausting. Like, how do you do that? It doesn't turn off. It's terrible. Like, honestly, it's the reason why I got all this gray hair. I'm just winding my life clock way too tight.
Nice. So also check out Blaster, which we've talked about, and what other systems things were we presenting here that you could give your shout out, say you know, talk about your projects.
Sure, yeah, go check out Gamma Wolves, check out Billion Suns, my buddy Mike's working on right now. It's brand new. You can check out Last Days Zombie Apocalypse, Relic Blade from Metal King Studios. Of course, This Is Not a Test, from buddy Joey McGuire. And Gaslands, if you haven't checked there, also by Mike. Who am I missing? Joe, Range of Shadow Deep from Joe McCullough and Frostgrave. Yeah. All that's good stuff. That's the Blaster Crew's bread and butter. We've all got different games in the fire. Everybody's got some new stuff coming out. We got a brand new miniature war game getting published in Blaster in April called Sludge.
Nice.
Which is sort of a horror-themed Napoleonics. So if you like that hashtag 28 stuff, if you're a big fan of like that kind of look and feel of a game, then Sludge might be for you, because Sludge is very much that kind of like gore and death. Like, imagine World War One was never fought with cannons, and it was fought in, like, forever with like pikes and muskets and charge light brigade horses and stuff like that. That's what Sean's done with Sludge, and it's cool as hell. And people can't die. They rub like this like mystical world root into their wounds and slowly turn into giant like pickle people. It's a messed up cool horror theme. After kind of like the cartoony lightness that is Relic Blade, he wanted to do something a little more metal, and it's extremely metal.
Nice.
Yeah, and the core rules of that, the full playable game will be in Blaster Volume 3.
Awesome. That's fantastic.
All right. Well, I think that about wraps it up. Thank you again, Ash, for stopping by and talking to us. Good luck with the assembly.
Thanks.
Cool. Well, on that note, I'm Owen.
I'm Chris.
And I'm Ash.
Yeah. See you next time. Intro music is Axe to Mouth by Pulp 45, which is Owen's old band. Outro music is Control My Fate by Ataraxia, which is Chris's old band. All songs used with permission. If you like what you hear, please like or subscribe. Thanks.
So we got down, and then Bobby and I were actually volunteering for CMON for the entire weekend. So, except for Immortal, we'd like wake up early in the morning, demo Wrath of Kings, do Zombicide things, run like the mini Dark Age tournaments and all that other craziness, and like not really sleep or eat, and just drink the entire time to like keep the pain away from like standing all day long and not sleeping properly. So we had, I think, a 2-hour break before Immortals. I got in one game of this army for the first and only time against Bobby, and then like pounded half a bottle of vodka. And I was like, all right, I'm good to go. Like, this is going to be great. This Immortals is going to be fantastic. And round one, you know, get paired with Ash. And I legitimately didn't put the two together until they're like, yeah, you're not in the main tables. Like, go over to this other table. And I walk over, there's like the full video game, like camera setup, you know, the dice tray under the camera, like all this other stuff. And it's like, yeah, you know, we're going to stream this to the thing and this and that. I was like, huh. And like instantaneously regretted drinking as much as I did like right before the thing.